Listen up. There's no more excuses.
We're empowering those who want the hustle by exposing the status quo.
The days of ordinary are over.
It's time to crush mediocrity and start discovering your greatest potential.
Welcome to the Hustle Nation.
To the Hustle Nation.
To the Hustle Nation.
To the Hustle Nation.
To the Hustle.
Welcome back to another episode of the Hustle Nation podcast. Today, as always, we've got a real treat. Mr. Ben Coalo is in the house. Ben is founder and CEO of Midwest Games, which is a video game publisher. Formerly worked at Netflix, 2K, Blizzard. I mean, this guy has a crazy background in video games, and I cannot wait to dive into this. Ben, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Ben, I found you somewhere online. I think you're pretty active in the community in Northeast Wisconsin. And when I saw your profile and I saw the video games, I just couldn't wait to invite you to talk about kind of what's happening not only in the industry, but also with Midwest Games. It's not too often you hear video games and Wisconsin in the same sentence.
No, in fact, we are the first video game publisher in Wisconsin's history. And so that's a really exciting thing. But actually, there's a long history of games in Wisconsin. Dungeons and Dragons was created in Wisconsin, in Lake Geneva. If you've ever heard of a con called Gen Con, the reason it's called Gen Con has nothing to do with like what you think it is. It's because it's from Lake Geneva, Gen Con.
Really?
And so there's a history of that. And there's actually a number of video game developers in Madison. There's a studio called Raven that works on Call of Duty, does like all of the online for Call of Duty. There is PUBG, which has one of their main offices right in Madison. There's a studio that's part of Gearbox, which is the creator of Borderlands, called Lost Boys, that is in Madison. And there's a number of others. Bethesda has a studio called Roundhouse. EA is building a Respawn studio that works on Apex Legends in Madison. So actually, there's a lot of activity, but no one's aware of it.
Yeah, I had no idea. So you were kind enough to tell me before we started recording what a video game publisher is. I'd never heard the term before we hopped on today, but I think it'd be helpful context to tell the audience what a video game publisher is.
Yeah. So if you think of a book publisher, where a book publisher is actually trying to find authors with great ideas, great books that they're working on, maybe established authors that are looking to create a new series, they help those folks finish out. They will sometimes fund their progress. You know, a lot of time is taken in order to write these things. In the games world, a lot of time is taken to develop the games and ultimately distribute them to market, whatever that is. In the game space, it's things like Xbox, PlayStation, on PC, it's Steam, and you know, Nintendo, Switch, and things like that. A publisher will help take all of that, all of those games, and will help localize, ensure that everything is tested with quality assurance, will provide production support, and then ultimately market and then distribute, like release them onto these platforms.
Very cool. We could go down a rabbit hole continuing that, but I want to go back a step and I want to hear about your journey, because you obviously grew up loving video games, playing them. I think we're actually part of a pretty unique generation in that our age range, Dustin and I can't speak for everybody, grew up. I mean, literally, I think I was in the first grade or kindergarten when Nintendo came out, and I remember vividly getting that, because before all we had was an Atari. And anyone out there listening that loves games, we had something called an Odyssey, which I don't know how to quantify what exactly that was, but anyways, a big part of our life. So how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting with games, because for our parents' generation, that wasn't a thing. This is the youngest entertainment industry, you know, in comparison to films and TV and a lot of these other mediums. Like, games is really, really young. Yet games is seven times bigger than films. And that surprises a lot of people how much bigger. And so for me, how I got into it was you know, Super Mario Brothers and Zelda and a lot of the classics. Luckily, my dad went on a business trip and my mom needed to entertain us and so bought us a Nintendo. And my dad wasn't happy about it. You know,
best babysitter of all time.
But ultimately, it was the spark that kind of inspired a lot of what I wanted to do. And so I grew up gaming and with everything I could possibly play. I love sports, but I didn't stick to just sports games. You know, I enjoyed shooters, but, you know, I love strategy. I love everything I could possibly play. And so I played a lot of different games growing up. And it was funny because my dad would always be like, you're wasting your time. You'll never do anything productive playing video games. And now he
all heard it.
Yeah. Now he has to eat that statement quite. and so it ultimately was a lot of just gaming, a lot of just, and what it gave me was critical thinking skills and, you know, exposure to wider worlds and new ideas. And I was able to do it, you know, through holding a controller in my hands.
Yeah. I think it's interesting when you talk about how pivotal the decision of getting the Nintendo was. Like the fact that you remember that, right? Like it's like the where were you when sort of, and I actually remember, so I'll never forget for us, the Nintendo, it was me and my sister went to like, it was like the local store. I don't know if it was Target or what it was, but it was like the small little Kmart. Gaming section. Probably was Kmart. That's probably what it was. And I'll never forget. It was the first time I realized there was sales tax because we had all pooled our money together and she's my older sister. And so it was $100, right? So we're like, oh, well, it's $100. Like, all right. So we pulled our money together. We show up, we buy it. And they're like, it's $105. And it might as well have been a million. We're like, where are we going to come up with the extra $5 yeah. to get this? And thankfully she was my older sister. So she was able to pony up an extra $5. But to your point, like you remember that, right? Cause that was it really was kind of a pivotal moment in time.
Yeah. I remember I played it in my parents' bedroom. I was born actually right outside Atlanta, Georgia, before being raised in Wisconsin. And I remember the bedroom. I remember like the wicker stand that it was. I don't know. Like, I can't remember anything. And yet I remember that. Yeah. And so, I just remember the first time it was turned on and like, you know, the excitement. And then later on, I remember getting an N64 at Christmas and, you know, and playing Mario Kart and Madden 64 and thinking Madden 64 had the greatest graphics ever. Now looking back, it's hilarious to imagine that was like the pinnacle of graphics at the time. But it was just incredible memories attached to gaming.
Same, you know, but that's just kind of a part of the nostalgia. When I think about childhood, I think there are a lot of people that may not even have grown up having a great childhood, but they remember certain things that brought them joy. And it could be video games, it could be sports, but man, for me, some of the best times I had were with, you know, brothers or were with friends and just battling over Madden or Contra or, you know, any of those things you brought up. It's so great to the point to where, you know, I have a bunch of mini arcades in my basement, just to kind of still relive some of that fun and now do it with my kids. And
Who would have thought? You know, during the pandemic, I have a house in LA and then also a spot in Green Bay, and I kind of go back and forth. But in my LA house, in my garage, I'm like, I had gotten rid of my car. And so I decided to turn my garage into a barcade. And so I got an original Ms. Pac-Man machine, and I got a Galaga 15-1 machine. And we got Jurassic Park pinball and then a skee ball lane, which skee ball will take us down a rabbit hole to be warned. I do play professional skee ball. And also skee ball has a Wisconsin connection. Baytech Entertainment, in Pulaski, Wisconsin is who, manufactures and owns the rights to skee ball. And so that is a Wisconsin product.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. And they're now invested in my company as well. So Skee-Ball has come back to reinvest into me, which all those dollars finally paid off.
You know, there's That's something amazing. About Skee-Ball that sounds very Wisconsin. Yes. You know, in a dive bar near you or arcade.
Or
Ben,
my garage.
I want to hear the story about Midwest games. You've got an extensive background with Netflix and Blizzard and 2K. You know, any gamers out there, even if they were just gamers as a kid, they know those names. How did this all come about?
Yeah, so as I was exploring, my university and what I wanted to do coming out of high school, I decided to be the big rebel of the family. I come from five generations that went to UW-Madison. My great-grandfather's a Hall of Fame football, basketball, track star there. Had a lot of family, play sports, run the W Club, do all that stuff. And I was like, I'm going to rebel. I'm going to go to UW Green Bay. Like it was so far away. but ultimately, I wanted to go into sports management. I wanted to create and help to build sports teams and do that. Spoiler alert, that failed massively. I didn't get the one internship that was available and ultimately didn't go into that and found myself having helped to create the radio station at UW Green Bay, going to radio after college. And so that was my first career journey, but it was awful. It was like the death of traditional radio time. I was selling literal air as my first job. I was getting paid like $12,000 a year, which I'm pretty sure is illegal because it's like $5 an hour. And, but you know, it's a sales job. So, you know, the fact that I couldn't sell air was my fault, not the company's fault. And so I did that and I was like, what am I doing? Like, this is not what I'm passionate about. This is not what I want to do with my life. And I ended up connecting with a recruiter from 2K on LinkedIn. And 2K was a pretty small publisher at the time. You know, NBA 2K and some of the 2K franchise was known, but the actual company 2K came together after that. 2K had, like, the game franchise had come together in the Dreamcast era as a way of, like, really selling the Dreamcast, but that wasn't actually connected to the company at the time. What happened was Take-Two, which is a video game publisher / conglomerate that's publicly traded that owns Rockstar Games, had a ton of success with Rockstar and was looking to add a bunch of their IP and bring together a new label. And so as a part of that, they acquired the 2K franchise, named the company 2K, but then brought a lot of other things into it, which is why it's kind of a mishmash of a number of different things, including NBA 2K, Borderlands, Bioshock, Civilization, XCOM, Mafia. But a lot of that didn't exist or exist in the franchises that they are today when I was hired into it. You know, it was kind of the beginning point of going from being a really scrappy startup type publisher that was taking big risks on things like Borderlands and Bioshock and moving it into this franchise building mode where, you know, the growth of NBA 2K really took off during that period. And Borderlands became a franchise. Bioshock became a franchise. We brought back XCOM. But I came in very early as just an operations coordinator. I was the only one. I reported to one of the executives in the company. The company is very small, but they offered me a position. And they said, you have to be out in San Francisco in 2 weeks if you want to take the position. I was like, okay. Packed up my car, drove across the U.S. and started at 2K 2 weeks later. I think it was right before the holidays in December. So I, you know, did that drive across like Nebraska and whatnot in the dead of winter to take this job. And so I ultimately had to jump at it because there was no opportunity in Wisconsin at that point. There was no opportunity in the Midwest. And so I either moved to California or I never got into games and decided to take the chance and to make the sacrifice and leave.
So I'm curious, you know, as you were making that jump, I mean, you really, you had, you know, grown up a passion with that, but, you know, curious what intrigued you so much about, you know, packing up and going across country, right? Cause I mean, to your point of being a little bit of the rebel, right? I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of people in your ear saying, you know what, go, you know, go do the easy route, go do the simpler path, right? Like, why are you going out to California? So, you know, curious just your mindset and how you approach that. Cause I'm, you know, I'm sure at the time there wasn't a lot of people being like, man, that just go do that. Cause to your point, games at that time was in a different world.
Yeah. It was against, you know, my dad's desires. He wanted me to be a banker. And there's no way I would ever be a banker. No offense to bankers. Like, you go do your thing, but that wasn't for me. And yeah, it was the fact that I was just willing to put myself out there and risk it all. And it could have blown it up in my face massively. But it was that or never fulfill the thing I wanted to actually do. And so for me, it wasn't really an option. It was like, you're going to go risk it all. And luckily, like, I've leaned into that throughout my career. That, you know, the reason I'm founding a company is, you know, you have to at times risk it all, jump into something else. Sometimes it doesn't work out, but you know, a lot of times you put yourself in a position, if not for the current thing in front of you, it's the next thing that might have positioned you well in that spot. And so that's a really big thing that I learned, but I learned by accident, just by putting myself out there and taking the risk.
So, you know, I think that's such an interesting point. We talk about it, you know, here a lot. I think a lot of people end up not achieving what they want to achieve simply because they're unwilling to take the risk. They're so afraid of, you know, failure or judgment or, you know, what the voice in their head is saying. And I think, you know, you're exactly right. Like, when you have kind of that mindset of, look, I'm just going to go, I'm just going to try it. And usually the reality is a lot better than what the perception is in your head at the time. So, you know, I think to kind of leapfrog off that. So, you get out there, you know, then, you know, being out in California, you made a lot of advancements, took on a lot of different kind of elevated tasks, even before you came back to Midwest. When was it, like, where in your journey did you start to think, you know, maybe something like Midwest could exist?
Yeah. So that was really when I was at Netflix. That was the moment that I was like, hey, this could be, you know, I now have learned enough. I now am just naive enough to go take a big risk like this and come back. And so it was really my time. I had joined Netflix in the very early days of film. And again, that was another jump. I had, you know, built this career at 2K, had been there for 6 years, really loved it. Jumped to Blizzard and worked in esports and did that for about a year. But Blizzard wasn't quite the place I wanted to be. And then an opportunity came with Netflix. And so I jumped into this film world, which was very different than games. And then that had led me to building out Netflix games from the ground up when Netflix wanted to get into games. So I didn't even realize that that would be an opportunity and end up being a perfect opportunity. So then at the Netflix juncture, having learned from the culture at Netflix and thought about, okay, well, how do you build a company right? How do you build a culture right? How can we make change in the games industry that needs change? That was the moment that I was like, okay, I feel like I have enough, you know, if I'm going on a journey, I have enough in my bags to help me get a lot of the way. And then, you know, the rest I'll figure out as I go. And I hope I'll find the right pieces that I need to continue to grow, to continue to elevate, to continue to, you know, ultimately learn and adjust and build over time. So I just had enough at that point, far from a perfect scenario, but if you wait for a perfect, it's going to be too late. I saw the opportunity at the moment. I jumped at it and just decided to take the big risk.
Ben, when I hear you talk about Netflix, it's interesting. That to me seems like and sounds like your catalyst for what helped you see this opportunity for Midwest Games. What was the experience? What was the knowledge you gained there that helped drive you or push you to get into Midwest Games?
Netflix is a really unique culture, and you can actually look up their culture deck. It's available online. People can look at it, and it really speaks to all of the values Netflix believes in. But the big thing is they demand a lot. They demand that you are your best self at Netflix, and you don't have any other options. Now, they also pay it. They pay you top of market to be the best of the best, and they expect you to always be the best of the best. And you either elevate to that level and become that, or you don't, and you get let go. And it's pretty quick. It can be brutal for some, but for a lot, it unlocks, you know, this next level that they might not have even realized that they could go to. And it involves giving you responsibility. So it's the opposite of a lot of other companies where you have rules and all the structure and all of this. Instead, Netflix treats you like an adult, treats you like a professional, treats you like somebody that is an expert in their field, and says, go make decisions. Go do the best thing you can for the company, and always think through the company's lens. And that allowed me to really think about things more holistically, because you get stuck at a job, like just thinking about the little thing that you're focused on, even if it's a big thing in this, you know, in the scheme of the business, you know, it's just one thing of many that come together that make up a business. If you're always thinking with a greater perspective on things, it's going to make your business better. And Netflix demands that you do that at all times. And then really gives you the ability to make the strong decisions that are needed in order to move the business forward. And so that kind of belief in myself helped to unlock my ability to go make strong strategic decisions, and then also make mistakes and learn from mistakes. And you have to be very loud about your mistakes. If you make a mistake at Netflix, you have to tell everybody you made the mistake. You have to, you know, fail loudly, and you have to have some vulnerability and some courage in order to do that. And it takes a lot to do it, and it sucks, but it encourages failure, but it encourages learning from failure and helping others learn from your failure so that they don't make the same failure. So you don't have repeated mistakes throughout the company, because people say, hey, look, I messed this up. I took this bet. Here's why I took this bet. Here's what didn't work out. Here's what I learned. And now you know for when you're making a decision and making a bet. And if you're going to make the same bet, do it differently. Learn from my mistake, or at least be in a different, you know, situation that the results could be different if you're going to make that bet.
So, you know, Ben, I think of just the progress you've made in a relatively short period of time. You know, you got funding. I know you've been expanding your leadership team, having some growth. You know, just curious, as you're assembling this team and assembling this organization, to your point of culture and, you know, the culture you're going to build at Midwest Games, curious, what are the things that you've taken from these previous organizations that you like, and what are things that you're going to make kind of unique to Midwest Games?
Yeah. So in building out my team, you know, it was really important that we get a group of people that can collaborate and learn together. You know, being part of a startup, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to do things wrong. We have to adjust to what our business is. You know, I can't just carbon copy what Netflix does and bring it to what I'm doing. I'm doing it at a different place. I'm doing it with different people. I also like that I'm a different leader than that. I'm not Reed Hastings. Like, and you know, he's a genius in so many ways, an incredible leader and ambassador for that way of doing business and that culture, but I'm not him. And that's okay. And so as I was looking at, well, how do I build a strong culture? The biggest thing is talking about it. You know, you have to bring it to your group and say, okay, what is our culture? What do we believe in? And what represents us? And you have to write it down, and you have to like lay it out for everyone that joins and encourage them to give feedback. And I think it's the biggest thing I learned from Netflix in regards to building culture is a strong feedback driven culture where anyone at any level can provide feedback and thoughts, and we encourage it, and we allow for folks to say, hey, I don't think that we're living up to it. I don't think that we're on track with where we want to be. And all of that's healthy, because then you can measure against and say, well, maybe we are, but in a certain area, we like there's nuance and there's challenges, but it creates a dialogue and discussion. No culture's perfect. No company's perfect. But the companies that are doing it right are encouraging people to speak up, to challenge leadership, because that allows for an ability to improve, to grow in all of the scenarios. And not everyone encourages that. Not everyone wants to hear the feedback, because sometimes it's difficult. And sometimes you have to, as a leader, say, oh, I was wrong about that. And some people just don't like it, especially when they have a lot of power and they have the say and the control. They don't like to be ever considered wrong, or they, you know, some people are just a little bit insecure. And it's not that I'm not, I'm just as insecure as any other person. It ultimately is just that I'm willing to say it and say that I could be wrong about this and hope that someone either says, no, actually, I think you're right. Or they say, yeah, this would be a better way we could do that. And I think that allows us to get to the best possible solution, which helps all of us and helps me, because it ultimately, if I'm like wrong all the time in the business and my people keep telling me, but I encourage that and they help direct us in the right way, on the outside, I look like a genius business person, even if I'm wrong.
You know, Ben, it's interesting you say that. One of the things I've shared a lot of times is I never want to be surrounded by bobbleheads.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you're surrounding yourself with people that are just, yep, yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, that's a great idea. It's a quick way to go down the wrong path. But to your point, if you're surrounded by people that are constantly challenging, you know, you're not always going to agree, but by that challenging process, you know, always allows you to get to a better solution.
Well, the greatest relationship, or one of the greatest relationships I saw this kind of exercise happen, was during my time at Netflix. I came from the more operations end, and I was working with a creative, of which, of course, I won't say his name. But we were, you know, we were going back and forth on some things. We just didn't see eye to eye. And, you know, it was just two very different sides of the coin. And, you know, and it was really frustrating. But what we did so well is we kept giving each other feedback. We kept sitting down one-on-one. We kept going through our challenges. Actually, what is so amazing about this, and I know he tells this story as well, from his own perspective, is by doing that exercise and by giving each other feedback, we actually got to a really good place. Not only to a good place, but we respected each other. We enjoyed working with each other. And we always knew where each other were going to go. I could, before I even said something, I could be like, I know you're going to have an issue with this, but here's why I think this is right. And I already knew what he was going to say, and the same on his end. And so we got to that, that place where we knew we both had good intent with what we were doing. We weren't trying to ruin each other's plans. And it allowed us to really be aware of the next thing that was coming up. And again, greater perspective of it. And then we actually became really good at collaborating together and doing some of the best work. And we were able to work on some of the biggest films ever put out on Netflix, which means some of the biggest films that have ever been put out in the world. And so it only got to that place by continuing to collaborate, continue to provide feedback, and really rough feedback at times, like stuff you didn't want to hear, but it allowed them them to give a different perspective and where they were coming from. And it allowed us to identify where our leadership was not aligned. And it wasn't, had nothing to do with us. It was actually our leaders. We could then let them know. And then they had to figure out things for us to be able to get better aligned.
That's amazing feedback for a lot of people, because there are a lot of entrepreneurs and leaders who have historically been conflict avoidant. And when I think of conflict, it doesn't necessarily have to be an argument or a fight, but it can be two people who just plain don't agree on things. And I think that is something missing in culture, that going from level A to level B, C to D, et cetera, that is something that needs to be embraced, because when you can learn how to collaborate and communicate, regardless of any type of conflict, it is unbelievable. And to hear you talk about that, that makes total sense. What's up, listeners? I just wanted to say thank you for being a part of the Hustle Nation community. We are absolutely thrilled and honored that you listen to our show. I wanted to take a break to share a special resource with you. I'm talking about our 2020 Vision Guide. This is a pivotal tool we use in our workshops, where participants typically invest thousands of dollars for transformative experiences. Imagine having a crystal clear, actionable roadmap to not just meet, but exceed your personal and professional goals. That's the power of the 2020 Vision Guide. And here's the best part. We're offering it to you for free. This is your chance to leverage a tool that has propelled hundreds of people achieve unparalleled success. Visit our website now. I'm including the URL in the show notes below, where you can download our guide and start your journey toward clarity and achievement. Don't wait. It's time to create the life you deserve today. Now back to the show. I'm curious, because as I hear you talk, Ben, It sounds like you and your organization, the organizations you've worked for, have learned to embrace change. And I noticed on your website, it says one of the things we believe in is change and creating change in games. I'm just curious, as your approach and as the approach of Midwest Games, how are you trying to change and create change in the industry?
Well, we're trying to change where games come from. So the thing about the games industry is we're still young. It's an immature industry, both from a standpoint of like just the longevity of it being around, but also, frankly, by some of the people in it are not always approaching things holistically. And ultimately, we have a lot of opportunity to change that. And so 67% of the video game industry in the U.S. is in three states, and really only four cities or regions: Seattle, San Francisco, L.A., a little bit in San Diego, and then Austin, Texas. And so really it's only that. And if the industry continues down this line, and the U.S. is tied for the largest market, sometimes considered largest, sometimes considered second, with China, and if we continue down that road, we're only ever going to get ideas from the same people over and over and over and again. And that's not going to create innovation. That's not going to encourage the representation of the world around us. And that's important, because if we don't have anyone making games from Wisconsin, the folks that identify with Wisconsin, that or the Midwest, aren't going to see or have games that fully represent them. Now, they're going to probably get some games they really enjoy and play, and we see that. But ultimately, there's so much more that can be created. And so a lot of what we're trying to do is, okay, taking bets elsewhere. What about the studios, in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is, where a studio we signed called Guiley Games is making Ra Ra Boom, which is a classic beat 'em up. The eras that we all know, with like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Contra, and
classic,
and things like that. Well, this one is a lot like that. In fact, it's inspired by that, but with incredible art, not pixelated art, and it is for female protagonists. So very much challenging the norm, I think, serving an underserved audience, because there's a lot of female gamers. There's a lot of male gamers that love to play as a female character, but rarely is a female character available to be able to play as. And this one has all the characters as female. But you know, more importantly, they're trying to save the world from AI. And we all need that right now, because apparently it's going to take over at some point. And so, apparently. But that was in Cincinnati. You know, we've signed a studio in Columbus, Ohio. We've signed a studio, you know, just outside Madison, Wisconsin, and many other in the Midwest. And these are incredibly talented people that just need support and funding in order to succeed. Imagine that, like an industry needing funding to succeed. It's hilarious to see people be like, oh, well, games can only be done in these certain places. And I'm like, why? The only reason it's done in those places is because funding is in those places, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You fund it there, and it happens there. Imagine that. And if you fund it in the Midwest, it will happen here. In fact, a proof point is the Nordic region. There has been a massive growth, in fact, to the point that it is one of the hubs, one of the main hubs in the world, in places like Helsinki and Stockholm. And that became that because there was investment in that. There was a couple successes, and then people started investing heavily in that. The talent was already there. And that the reason I can't compare that region is it's so similar to the Midwest in so many ways. In fact, a lot of immigrants from those regions came to the Midwest, and that's where they have settled. And so the comparison of talent is, you know, on par with one another, but the Midwest doesn't get any funding. So that is really what we're trying to change and challenge, is we can have more success come from more places, but you have to invest in it. You have to support it. Otherwise, it doesn't have a chance.
I love what you said there about changing the narrative on where things happen in these three main cities in the United States, where, you know, if we look in different places, we can find different talent, and we can change perceptives. We can change the way we've always gone about it, because growing up playing video games, it was the same thing, the same game, different format, different character, but it were all kind of the same. And it wasn't until, you know, you kind of got into the PlayStation era where things changed a little bit. And even now, I mean, video games are wildly different. And I'm sure that you may not see it that way, but it is fun to see that change. And yeah, I mean, people think differently in the Midwest, and people want different things. And it's good to know that it doesn't have to come from Silicon Valley or major metropolitan areas.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't. And there are so many incredible new genres. The great thing about games is genre blending. There's a lot of different types of things that have blown up. You know, MOBAs came from genre blending, and that became a huge thing. Now, people trying to go into it these days, I think it's really tough to build one, but it worked for a while. And some of the biggest games are in that space. But games like Power Wash Simulator, you know, all it is you go power wash stuff, and it has done so incredibly well because there's a segment of audience that loves to do that. There's something that just is you know, very pleasing about that, really like clean cut lines of something being power washed, and that was an incredibly successful game. And so imagine if we only are investing in the same things, like that would have never been something. And the audiences, the tens of millions of people that have bought that game would not have had something that they enjoyed as much as that game. And so by investing in some of these areas, you're going to be surprised by audiences that attach onto it, because games is culture. It's bigger than films. It's bigger than TV. It's bigger than music. In fact, it's bigger than all of those things combined times two. And it is the center of culture. And so we don't really know what the next thing is going to be. There's always something new. Vampire Survivors came out of nowhere with what they built as well. And ultimately, like, we have to invest in new areas and new innovation, because we never know where the audience might go next. They change so quickly from game to game that you can't just predict success in the games industry. And so we have to invest in new places, and we also have to invest more sustainably. A lot of investment has gone towards this AA, AAA space, which is like, in games terms, is like blockbuster type of films, like the big spends, you know, more than like $50 million to like hundreds of millions of dollars per game. Now that's really risky, especially if things are dynamic and changing, like changing at a rapid pace, and people, you know, people's tastes are changing. That's a big investment for something that could massively fail and barely sell any units. So why not invest in places that are more cost reasonable? You know, in Wisconsin, the cost of living is a fraction of what it is in a place like San Francisco. The quality of life is much higher. What if we think about games in a more sustainable way, so that we can have studios that can actually work on multiple games over time and not have to have them blow up into some big success to succeed? Because what we've seen data-wise is, and it's logical, is the more games a studio works on, the more likely they are to succeed with every subsequent game. I mean, it's obvious, but that's not how our investment in games is aligning. So we're not actually setting that up for success.
So I'm curious, as people are looking at developing those games, you know, in a lot of businesses you have like the MVP product, right? Where it's, you know, you're starting, you're testing it out, you're getting feedback. And, you know, then there's this other strategy of where we're going to build it to where we can be proud of it. And then we're going to release it. You know, as you talk about kind of these studios working on multiple games, how does that tend to work? Are they going more down this MVP path of, you know, we're going to start by, you know, releasing this game at this level and then we'll build upon it? Or does it have to get to a certain extent before, you know, frankly, anyone's going to fund it, or you can even really get it onto platforms?
So the cool thing about the game space is there's actually multiple routes. You can go a route where you have something built at kind of a bare bones state, and you could actually release it as a paid game onto Steam as like an early access launch, meaning it's not finished. It's being worked on, iterated on, but it allows a community to come in, to be invested, to play it, to give feedback on it, and for it to grow over time. And so that becomes a lever where you can ultimately help fund the growth of that game as you're developing it. Some games just don't fit that model quite as well, and you have to get funding. Now, there's more routes to funding than ever before. It used to just be, well, you're either going to bootstrap it yourself, or you're going to get a publisher that will fund it from the beginning, from kind of a paper pitch or early prototype type of state, and then all the way until launch. And there's availability of kind of all of these things now. And with angel investors and venture coming into the space, some of the early, more risky type investments have been taken on by other kinds of investors that aren't video game publishers. There's only 200 video game publishers worldwide, so there's not many. So it's really hard to get published. If you look at a platform that has like open data availability like Steam, you can see that 98% of games on Steam are self-published, meaning they don't have a publisher. And that's over 14,000 games per year. Over 40 games per day come out on Steam. Wow. And so there's just a glut of content that is just constantly coming out. But that 98% only makes about around 25% of total revenue on Steam. So 75% is made by 2%, which is the publishers. And that's because there's a lot that comes with the publishing. You get the marketing and the PR and the community, but you also get quality assurance, testers to be able to make sure your game is the best it can possibly be. You get localization so that it can truly go global and hit new markets. You get production support so it stays on track. You get release management so that it even just successfully releases on those platforms, and then being able to port to other platforms, move it to Xbox or PlayStation or Steam or many other platforms. And so all of that helps you go above and beyond, which is why having a publisher really helps. But with so few publishers, you have to come up with alternative routes of things. There's over 150,000 game development studios, maybe even more than that, because a lot are kind of underground doing other things. They might, you know, we signed a game where the guy's day job is he works in insurance. And then, you know, in the nights and weekends, he works on his game. And unless he talked about it, and in fact, he's only ever gone to one show to show it off, which is where we found him and signed him. You wouldn't have known that. And so he, you know, taught himself, he's using a non-traditional engine, all that kind of stuff. And ultimately they're everywhere. A lot of people love to make games and do it on the side, and they don't see themselves as entrepreneurs, when in reality, they're exactly that. They're just doing it in the gaming space.
That brings up a really interesting thought. You know, as you talk all about this industry and how big it is, two things. One, I'm surprised that, you know, when you look at it being bigger than music and film, how is it that video games doesn't get as much radio play, TV play, get as much acknowledgement? Why doesn't it have its own award show? Maybe it does. I don't know. But with all the people playing games, I mean, they're now parents are playing games. Grandparents are gamers, whether it be with their grandkids or by themselves. It is such a big population. How come there's not more of this?
Well, so there is a game show, a games awards show called the Game Awards. And it happens every December. And it's huge. It's huge, huge. It's so much bigger than every other award show. It's all perception. It's all marketing. It's all like the publicity around it. People just don't think about it. In fact, there's been a couple games this year that have beaten the highest blockbuster film ever, and already this year. It's March, and so, you know, it is just it's a perception issue that people don't look at it. And games is all around us at all times, so people take it for granted because it's just the central piece of everything that we do, whether it be video games, board games, you know, just casual games that you're playing on your phone while you're at the airport or you're traveling. The games are what ultimately entertain us at all times. And these other things are just like the you know, the kind of rare exceptions. You know, you go to the movie theater, like you don't go to the movie theater very often these days, or most people don't. They do for certain titles, but it's a larger investment of time and money to do that, an effort that people don't want to do. The cost per minute played on a game, like if you look at how much you spend on a game compared to how much you actually play a game on average, you know, there's so much room for growth in games, because a movie you're spending, you know, what, $11 or something per hour watching something. Whereas a game, you know, yeah, you might spend $30 to $60 to $100 at this point, but you're also getting like probably double the amount of hours per dollar spent. So there's a bunch of studies around all of that. But as to like why people don't understand that, I just don't think they take games as seriously, even though everyone's a gamer in one way or another. And there's like 3.8 billion like gamers that are considered more like in the casual to core, but that game consistently, I forget what the exact stat is, but a couple hours a week that they're gaming.
I love that. It's a real education in the gaming industry. And as much as I thought, you know, even as a dad now, I still respect and appreciate video games, and I see it through a different lens. I don't necessarily see it as some people they're being a negative, as you know our parents did when we grew up playing video games. So this knowledge has all been amazing. But before we let you go, I have to ask you, what's next in the world of games, video games, and gaming? What are you excited about? What do you expect to change in this industry?
Yeah. So what's next, you know, is cloud gaming. So I've talked about, you know, in a couple other podcasts and interviews, I've talked about the eras of games. You know, you had the whole arcade era. Remember that? And you'd put in quarters, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then we moved into a console era, and then we moved into a more digital era that like had console connections and everything like that. In the next 5 to 10 years to maybe 15 at the longest, although I think with technology speeding up constantly, I think it's going to be 5 to 10 years. Cloud gaming is coming, and cloud gaming is all about accessibility. You play anything on any device, anywhere in the world, with anyone, and your ability to just to engage in a game that you wouldn't traditionally on your phone. Imagine playing Halo on your phone, you know, on a bus. Like, it's just the ability to access games at any point. There's going to be a shift towards more services, like similar to how Netflix has done streaming. No, there's no wonder why Netflix is getting into games as well. You know, Xbox Game Pass, you can kind of see the early stages of what this is becoming, but accessibility is going to be the future of games, which is only going to further expand the audience. In fact, that's the only thing that's held games back in any way, is not everyone could afford a console. Not everyone could afford doing some of these things that in the future you're going to be able to access any of these games. And it's really just like, what service are you using? And how are you engaging with it? And that's what I'm really, really, really excited about. And then, you know, for my company as a content provider, to be able to look at, you know, different services and sell to whoever best aligns with what we're trying to build.
It's amazing. It's amazing that the fact you get to have a hand in developing the games of tomorrow, the things that, you know, my children and little kids growing up are going to be playing for maybe decades, like we did mm-hmm. with games like Mortal Kombat and Tecmo Bowl and things like that. So what an incredible opportunity you have. And I mean, just when I think about what I studied in high school, my guidance counselor, it's like, how come you didn't tell me I could do stuff like this? How come this stuff wasn't available?
Because it wasn't available at that time, sadly. That's what we have to build. And so we need more support, because the reality is, your kids could be doing this, but we need more businesses, more investment in the Midwest to be able to enable people to do it, you know, here in the Midwest, rather than having to ship off a lot of really talented, in fact, some of our most talented, some of our best critical thinkers off to other places, because those people could be in games in Wisconsin, and then they could go, hey, actually, with all of this like perspective, because you're combining technology, art, entertainment, all into one area, you're working with artists and engineers and people, like the ability to solve other problems, maybe in the healthcare industry, or maybe in manufacturing, or more traditional industries, but taking somebody with a lot of perspective and problem solving abilities and critical thinking abilities and putting them into these other areas where they might have been in games for a while, but want to explore other areas once they're in games. We have the ability to do that. And that's the benefit places like California are getting by having large gaming populations that come from the industry.
Great perspective. Love that. Ben, thank you so much for your time today. This is an incredible conversation. This is the first time we've talked about video games and this industry. It's always enlightening having on new people with different perspectives. So thank you for that. Before I let you go, where can people find you if they want to connect with you or learn more about Midwest Games?
Yeah, MidwestGames.com is a really good way. Otherwise, I'm very active on LinkedIn. I have a large industry following on there. I share a lot of my thoughts. I'm a little bit active on Twitter, but more on unhinged thoughts of things. And then LinkedIn is probably the best route, especially if you want to reach me directly. Just be aware I get hundreds to thousands of messages at a time. I try to get through them all. Don't always. So keep at it if you are going to try to reach out to me on there.
And you do respond because you responded to me.
Yeah,
so
90. I'd say 95% of the time I respond.
Yeah. Are there any games you're promoting right now? Any Midwest yes. games you're excited about that we can go play?
Yeah, there's a game called Duck Paradox available on Steam right now, which is on your PC. It is in early access, an incredible platformer that is just hilarious in a lot of ways. Really, really difficult, but will give you kind of retro feel with ducks. You're trying to save your pet duck from a multiverse you accidentally sent them into, and then there's evil versions of your duck. So almost like Loki plus, you know, Duck Hunt. We have that, and then a couple other games that were about to release: The Lullaby of Life, also on Steam, Rah Rah Boom, Dark Sky. And then we're going to be announcing some more titles coming up. We've actually signed 6 titles. We're about to sign 6 more. So there's a lot more coming from Midwest Games.
Wow. A lot of fun. That sounds great. I can't wait to go check it out. I'm going to go see what this Duck Paradox is all about. Ben, enjoy. Thank you for your time today. We appreciate you. That was fun. For all the listeners out there, thanks for tuning in to another episode. Until next time, peace.
Thank you for being part of the Hustle Nation. If you're serious about raising the bar in your personal and professional life and willing to go all in on your success, head over to HustleLeaders.com. Here you can get access to our Hustle Productivity ebook, attend our Hustle Masterclass, or challenge yourself to the 30-Day Hustle Challenge. Pairing these tools and training with the Hustle Nation podcast will help you advance to a whole new level. Until next time, stay hungry and inspire those around you to hustle.